L-E-D-E-N-E-T.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On this episode, I'm joined by Leanne Burnham-Richards, Vice Chair of the UK Paranormal Society. We discuss the Society's aims as a charitable organisation, some of Leanne's paranormal experiences, ethical ghost hunting, along with Leanne's time spent working at the notorious Ancient Ram Inn. A big thank you to Leanne for joining me on this week's show. But before we get to the interview, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. A big thank you to my two latest patrons, Patricia and Ethany. Thank you both for your support, and thank you to each and every one of you that continues to support Mysteries and Monsters each and every month. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Please visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. You can also subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. In regards to merchandise, I have some big news. I've got a new site through TeePublic with a whole range of new merchandise available. There's a link in the show notes. And to celebrate this new relationship, TeePublic are holding a flash sale, so all merch will have 35% off for the first 3 days. So from this Monday, go grab yourself some bargains. And if you get something, make sure you tag us on social media so we can share it far and wide. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Today I'm delighted to delve back into the paranormal with the Vice Chair of the UK Paranormal Society joining me, Leanne Burnham-Richards, a passionate advocate of preserving heritage and history, along with bringing a more unifying umbrella of positive paranormal unity. Leanne, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Often, Leanne, when I speak to people involved in the paranormal, they are people that have an experience from living in a haunted home, or they were obsessed with ghost stories or things like that as a child. But having heard you speak previously, it seems that your father had a very attentive attempt to increase your horror film tolerance at a very young age, and that's what kind of sets you on your weird and wonderful path.
That is very true, yes. Instead of watching, you know, maybe The Simpsons or any other child-friendly TV program, my dad would let me and my brother watch It, Child's Play, Bad Taste, everything, Nightmare on Elm Street, just everything that a nine-year-old child shouldn't be watching, basically. You know, having Barbie dolls and then watching a film like Child's Play, you know, wasn't the best thing. I was sure my Barbie dolls were going to kill me when I went to bed at night. So.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, with my love of horror films, Leanne, there's plenty of scarier
doll films out there that you could watch. I know there's a particularly terrifying episode of The Twilight Zone, which I think is Talking Tina, from about 1964, that when I saw that the very first time, it scared me far more than seeing Child's Play, even though Child's Play made me feel deeply uncomfortable even as a teenager. I'm pretty similar, really. I saw a lot of films that weren't age appropriate, but I was one of those people. I never really suffered. There's only a couple of them when I look back that really scared me, and when I look back at them, they're both, one of them's rubbish. It's called Snow Beast, and it's not particularly scary. In fact, it's wonderfully crap, as horror films go. But when you're 8 or 9 and you're at your grandparents on a Saturday night, you don't expect to see a bloodthirsty Yeti running around Colorado.
No, definitely. And you can't rationalize it when you're 8 or 9. you think it's certain fate that your dolls are going to come to life and try to murder you. So it's probably not the best thing to do. But no, I looking back, watching them now, I'm like, it's not that scary. But in all fairness, it's definitely built up a tolerance for horror films now. So not a lot scares me anymore.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I suppose that's a good thing, and it's also a bad thing. I went to see Late Night with the Devil on Sunday, which is a much vaunted film that was getting some rave reviews on the festival circuit last year. And I saw the trailer and I thought, actually, this could be really quite interesting. And I have to say, the last 20 minutes, it really felt like I'd been gut punched. It just ripped my guts out in a metaphorical sense. And I was left sat there at the end going, oh, my God. In a good way.
Yeah. I was planning on seeing that, but my friend cancelled at the last minute, so I had no one to go to the cinema with me. And in hindsight, I should have just gone on my own.
Yeah.
But I'm going to probably have to wait until it comes out onto streaming services now.
Yes. Shudder, I think, has got it on the 19th of April. Not that that's an advert, but I'd just like to pass it on. Because for me, if I see a better horror film this year, I'll be amazed.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Incantation?
Yes.
That film definitely stayed with me for a long time after. I thought that was very cleverly done. It was more I think it had a psychological element, which I thought was really, really good. And don't want to, you know, give too much away, but at the end of the film, I actually shut my eyes because I was like, I don't know if I want to take the risk. No, I'm just going to shut my eyes, you know. So it definitely had an effect on me.
Yeah, I think they're the ones that often catch you unawares, really. Talk to Me last year was very similar in that. That I wasn't really expecting a lot from that. And I'm kind of, by 1987, Leanne, I was sick to death of Ouija board based films.
Yeah.
Even at that era. So I was very interested to see how they do it. And it's one of those films that's extremely impressive because it has a very unlikable lead character. It kind of messes around with the Ouija board connecting with the dead by using the alleged embalm hand of a psychic.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes from 0 to 60 in about 30 seconds halfway through the film, but you're just like, what on earth is going on here?
Yeah, it was very, very clever. It wasn't a typical jump scare type film. It was, again, that more psychological build up made you really think, you know. So I did enjoy that film as well.
I think one of the things that struck me about it, through my personal experience, is it kind of showed the addictive quality of that kind of paranormal fun that they were all having, because they were just having a good time talking to the dead. And it reminded me of a young person growing up when myself and my friends discovered Ouija boards. And I look back and I think we must have been doing it 4 or 5 times a week for like 2 or 3 hours a night, up to a dozen of us just hanging around. And you kind of, I think sometimes you can kind of forget how addictive certain aspects of the paranormal are when you first enter it. And so I was really taken by that, because I think sometimes films don't show the fun aspects of it. Obviously, it all goes horribly wrong, but I think in the vast majority of times, it's just lots of people mucking around with their friends and trying to scare each other.
Definitely. And like, that's one thing that I love about the paranormal is I would say I am addicted to that adrenaline. You know, that fear, you know, I'm not necessarily fond of the dark, which, you know, isn't the best quality to have. But I like that fear. I like going on an investigation, hearing something or witnessing something that does get you a bit, you know, a bit scared. I think that's an enjoyment. And definitely that's what brings me to the paranormal.
How did your paranormal journey evolve from being a lover of horror films as a younger person, Leanne, to then sort of getting involved and associating yourself with both the UK Paranormal Society and obviously, as we'll touch on, strangely enough, a venue I've never really covered in 5 years of this show, which is the Ram Inn.
Yes.
I'm very interested. What made you jump across? Was it that you just developed an interest from seeing horror films to start reading about ghosts and hauntings and investigators? Or was it something that you had friends who got into it and you kind of got led down that path along with them?
So I started off watching, like I said, horror films as a child, liked that fear, kind of, you know, ended up seeking out that fear, you know, starting to watch more paranormal TV shows as I became an adult. When I was about probably 22, me and my partner were living in a house in Calne in Wiltshire. And at the time, there were some strange things going on. We would hear footsteps running up the stairs in the middle of the night. We were in a terraced cottage. It was a very old cottage. And one side of us was a very elderly couple who would not be able to run at that speed. Mm. And the cottage on the other side of us, it was empty. There was no one living there. Mm. So we would hear footsteps running up the stairs in the middle of the night. We would hear what sounded like pebbles, I guess, dropping in the attic onto the ceiling of our bedroom. Mm. My partner would wake up in the middle of the night sleep talking, and he never did that before. And he woke up one night, pointed at the door and said, "Get out." And I suddenly woke up and was like, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I had a dream that somebody was stood in the doorway of the bedroom. Mm. Couple of nights later, we both wake up to our bedroom door opening. And it was like I said, it was an old cottage. So the door was like a latch type lock. So you had to like physically press down one end to lift it up over the little stopper, I guess. And that was really strange. And then there'd be times, you know, where you're in the shower and I thought my partner Sam was walking in and I'd go, "Hello," and I'd push the curtain back and nobody was there. So there was definitely something spooky going on in that house. And I started to watch more paranormal kind of TV shows, mainly American ones, like, you know, Ghost Adventures, Ghost Hunters, My Ghost Story, you know, people's personal experiences. And yeah, and I just loved it. I was just fascinated by it. And then I ended up seeing a advertisement on my Facebook for a paranormal group that was local to me called Ghostly Goings On. Mm-hmm. And they said, "We're looking for investigators. You know, anybody want to join our team?" And I was like, "Yes, let's do this. Let's join," you know. So from there, my first investigation with them was at 30 East Drive. Mm-hmm. And all the other team members were like, "Whoa, you've been thrown in the deep end, 30 East Drive." And I was bricking it, you know, like I was so terrified. Yeah. But yeah, it was great. So then I started, you know, working with the events company side of things. And then I had my son and I took some time out and then put up on Facebook, like, "Oh, I really want to get back in the paranormal, do some more investigations and stuff." And that's when Paul Hobday, who is the chair of the UK Paranormal Society, dropped me a message and was like, "Oh, I've got something I think you might be interested in. Like, you know, let's meet up. You know, it's all top secret. I can't say anything." And I was like so intrigued. I was like, "This sounds amazing." You know, so yeah, met up with Paul and he went over this idea for the UK Paranormal Society and what he wanted to create for the paranormal community. And that's what I've been doing since 2019, which is crazy how long it's been since the very first, like the conception of the idea to now.
Yeah, because obviously looking at the organization's history, this wasn't a sort of couple of months prior to launching and then doing it. There seems to have been a lot of groundwork built into it, Leander. It wasn't something that Paul just sort of threw together and just bounced a couple of ideas about. This seemed to have a real sort of planned gestation period over 2 or 3 years prior to going live. Because one of the things that strikes me is that it's a charitable organisation, which I think, especially in the paranormal and some of the interesting characters, shall we say, that have dipped their toes into this field on in various countries around the world. Paranormal investigations and charitable organisations do not often go hand in hand unless it's usually a sponsored ghost hunt or something for a worthwhile cause.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this was one of the reasons when we first all got together and started coming up with ideas for, you know, who we wanted to be, what we wanted to represent in the community. We also had to decide what type of organisation we were going to be. Were we going to run as a business? You know, were we going to be a charity? And we felt that it was setting the right tone to be a charity, to show that it wasn't about anyone's personal gain. We weren't here to make money. It wasn't about, you know, kind of, you know, building our own personal brand. You know, being a charity, it was about the organization. You know, that was at the forefront of everything. It wasn't, you know, we weren't going to have like a celebrity at the forefront that was, you know, it wasn't about that. It was about the organization, which I think, you know, choosing to be a charity really set those kind of quite a strict, not strict, but quite a it made us dedicated, and we stuck to a certain kind of path, I guess.
I think one of the things, and maybe it's because I'm more immersed in it, because I've always been interested in the weird and the wonderful all my life, Leanne. But obviously doing this now for 5 years, I am far more aware of people and organisations and teams and investigators all over the place, and also have found myself deeply uncomfortable a lot of the time when I see certain investigations or researchers on certain social media platforms who seem to thrive on controversial hauntings or events. And I think when I became aware of your organization, sort of the last 18 months, I think it really struck a chord with me, because it seems that whilst there's often been a lot of exaggeration or perhaps people performing to the more flamboyant aspects of the paranormal, it seems that there's always been an ethical line of when is a haunting too recent to be justifiably investigated, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think often when we talk, especially here in the UK, you can't, there aren't many counties that don't have some kind of bloody battlefield lurking in one of its corners, Leanne, or a tragedy from a war, or we've all got famous ghosts that were taken down during the restoration of the monasteries, or the Tudor dynasties, or the numerous incursions into our neighbours just to sort of make sure that everything was okay over the centuries. Whereas I think in the modern era, a lot of people seem to be trying to create that kind of glorification of certain events in a paranormal sense, which still leaves an extremely bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah, I think, you know, we see it all the time with clickbait. You know, people want the demon house, the murder, the evil entity, because it gets people clicking on the links. And I'm sure you saw it over lockdown when people weren't able to go out and investigate. They would go into, you know, the abandoned buildings, and probably a building which had no real history to it. It was just an abandoned house. But for, you know, the clicks and the followers and the likes, they had to create a history, you know, or we're going to go into the murder house tonight and create a fake history, because 99.9% of the followers aren't going to do any research on the location, and some of the Facebook lives and the YouTubers and stuff wouldn't necessarily put the location out anyway. So people don't necessarily know what building they're going to. But, you know, and like you said earlier about the when is it too recent to do an investigation? And to be honest, it's a real grey area. You know, I think people have got to use their common sense, you know, have respect. If something has happened in the last decade or so, it's probably not right to investigate, especially when there's children involved or somebody is still suffering the grief of the loss of that person. I think that's when it can be a bit unethical, you know. But the thing is, that's the thing, we're not, the society at least anyway, are not here to tell anybody what to do. it's to kind of raise the idea of people having ethical standards, investigators, you know, doing investigations ethically, respectfully, not spreading any misinformation, etc. And just leading by example, because we're not here to tell anybody what to do, because to be honest, the people that act unethically aren't necessarily going to be the ones that are going to go, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't think, you know, they're going to do what they want to do regardless. But I think by other people in the community going, oh, actually, I didn't think of it like that. Oh, I didn't, you know, it's then going to make the ones that act unethically stand out more if everybody else is acting ethically.
Mm.
So lead by example, basically.
Yes. It's a difficult thing. I'm not sure, because I've also always had a real interest in true crime and serial killers, but not in that kind of way that I've seen that kind of mature, shall we say, recently, where that seemed to be a lot of glorification of certain individuals with absolutely no thought to the victims. And I think especially televisual documentaries about specific individuals has seen a real sort of moving away from glorifying these very dangerous people and focusing more on the actual victims and their stories. Because I think, as with anything, outside of somebody like Jack the Ripper, most people wouldn't be able to tell you any victims of any notorious serial killer, especially here where I am. I doubt many people would know anybody that the Yorkshire Ripper killed, sadly. But that seems to have been changed. And I've noticed the last couple of documentaries about that particular subject has really focused on the women and the victims and the scenarios and the situations that were going on in West Yorkshire during that period and what was causing it, and that sort of the machinations of how that kind of derailed the investigation, because as often is seen, it's only when it gets to a certain number that police begin to take certain things seriously, because of the people who are being targeted are sometimes thought of as less of a human being because of their unfortunate circumstances that have seen them in situations where they do turn to sex work or they're drug addicts. Leah.
Yeah, it's the you know, it's the marginalized members of the community that get overlooked. Mm. And that's why you say the focus tends to be more on the serial killer. You know, I agree. I love true crime as well. It fascinates me, you know, the why and the how and, you know, what causes somebody to do that. You know, it is fascinating. But, you know, I probably don't give the victims as much focus as I possibly should, you know, so that's something that I possibly need to work on. And but it's true, you know, you have the documentaries about Dahmer and Ed Gein and John Wayne Gacy and Manson, and everybody knows the face of those serial killers. And you can look at a picture of one of them and go, oh, that's so-and-so, but you kind of, the victims get unfortunately forgotten about, you know. But I do think you're right. I think people nowadays tend to want to do right and they want to be good people, and I think they are raising awareness of the way that things were done in the past, and hopefully in the future going forward these serial killers don't get the glamorization that they do, because a lot of them do it because they want to be immortalized. They want to be famous. You know, they love the attention, and that's what gets them off, you know. So if hopefully we could get to the point where people don't, that would be great. But you see it all the time. You see people writing love letters to people in prison, and they're attracted to people that do heinous, disgusting crimes. And unfortunately, again, like I said earlier, they're the people that you're never going to convince, you know, make them think otherwise. So I think focusing on the people that are open and are willing to look at things a different way is where you should focus your energy, because unfortunately, you're never going to change the people on the other side of it.
I suppose that's one of the key aspects of what the UK Paranormal Society is wanting to achieve, is that we have this more ethical, investigative and sort of collaborative format going forwards. Because I think when we're talking about situations like that, I mean, a prime example of talking about how recent is too recent. You only look at off the top of my head, two prime examples of similar disasters. One is known as a notorious haunted location in London, and the other one nobody ever talks about, which is the tragic events of the Bethnal Green tube crush during the Second World War, where a massive stampede happened by accident. They're not sure what caused it, and several, I think 160 people were crushed. The majority were women and children. Wow. Sorry, the majority were women and children. That is known as a notoriously haunted station on the Underground. Growing up, I remember the horrific events of the King's Cross tube station fire, which happened in the late 80s, which was caused by a discarded cigarette igniting rubbish hidden under an escalator, and dozens of people died there. Nobody ever talks about that one. And I think that kind of shows you that these are both extremely tragic accidents that have happened in a public space. Mm. One seems to be fine because it was 80 odd years ago. The other one is still, I suppose, for a lot of people in their living memories who had to deal with it, Leanne. And I think when we've got a paranormal investigation going on sometimes, as you say, sometimes people will look for things that are too recent because how things work these days, that it gets the clickbait, as you referred to earlier, and people's eyes are on it, when really there doesn't seem to be any ethical justification in doing that other than you want that attention. And I don't think that's, if anything, it's abhorrent.
Yeah, and I think it is hard because it is a grey area. Like, you know, we can't sit here and say, oh, well, anything that's happened in the last 20 years is off limits, but 21 years is fine. You know, it's one of those questions which, you know, I feel like I should have an answer for, but it's a grey area and I can't give a certain time frame. It's people have to, you know, make their own judgment.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. It's one of those things. I'm not sort of suggesting that you should give me the rules, and I'm certainly not going to suggest that I should give you the rules either. But it is an interesting dilemma, I think, that because we all love stories about haunted houses and forlorn ghosts wandering around, and often there's a lot of tragedy involved in some of these stories, and it does sometimes, when you take a step back and you look at it, you think we're talking about some horrific events on occasions. It just happened to have happened 300 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. And like, you know, you have to stop and think, like, this was a real living person that potentially had a horrific death, and we're using their death to sell tickets to an event.
Yeah.
So there is something quite, I don't know, when you really strip it back to that, it sounds quite gross. You know, but I don't know, like, it's, you know, when we talk about investigating historic buildings and locations, I speak to so many people that say that they do it because they want to contact the individuals that perhaps lived there in the 1800s or the 1700s and have a conversation with them and to continue their story, I guess, you know. So that's what I think draws a lot of people to the paranormal, is, you know, there's so many, you know, stories online about, you know, this woman was killed, this man was a murderer, this tragedy happened. And I think investigators would love to communicate with those victims in those old historic buildings to actually hear from them themselves.
How have you sort of grown in regards to your use or the way that you work in regards to paranormal investigations, Leanne, since you both pre the formation of the society to afterwards, have you noticed that you have changed the way that you conduct yourself? Not that I was suggesting that you were running around trying to create havoc, but I think often we all have sort of preconceived ideas, either through watching too many television shows telling us how we should be doing it, to then actually going out to site to see how it's really done when it's not being edited for television. And I think sometimes a lot of us are quite frightened to admit that we don't know as much as perhaps we think we do. And I think often, especially when it comes to anything in the weird, there will always be people who are often put forward as experts, but I think none of us really know everything, and none of us will ever know everything. And I think the more of us that are happy to hold our hands up and say, I'm sorry, I don't know, or I'm not sure, or we continue to grow whether we know we are or not, or the people that we surround ourselves with, or the locations that we go to, or as yourself being involved in the UK Paranormal Society, has it sort of completely changed? If you looked at how you were 10 years ago, would you say you're a very different sort of paranormal investigator?
I think so. When I started out, I remember one of my first investigations at Little Dean House Hotel. And I remember getting my phone out in the investigation, turning the flash on, and I'm filming a video. And I'm there going, oh, my God, guys, I just caught an orb. And I was convinced that I had just caught proof of paranormal activity within the first 10 minutes of an investigation. I was probably a bit arrogant, like, well, you know, I'm a natural. But I found myself slowly over time starting to pick up on things, because it's public investigating is fascinating, because you go on a public investigation and you've got different types of people. You've got the people there with all the gadgets, and that's what they love. You know, they've got every bit of equipment known to man. You've got the people who are the spiritualists. You know, they're the ones doing the protection spell before the night starts. You know, then you've got the people who are skeptics because they've been dragged along to this event by their girlfriend and they don't want to be there, but they're there, you know, so they're going to be like, I'm going to find a rational explanation for everything tonight, you know. And you know, there's all these different variety of people on investigations, and I was just fascinated learning from all of them, because to be honest, and there was also another thing as well, was the people that were there just because they wanted to be scared.
Yeah,
you know, like the group, I've been on investigations with groups of women on a hen do before. So there's so many different varieties of people that go on to a public, you know, ghost hunting event. And it's just fascinating watching all of them, because you can learn from all of them. You know, you're there looking at the person with the gadget and you're like, oh, OK, well, you know, what does it mean that it's getting colder? You know, how did that set off? So you're starting to look into the tech side of stuff. And then you're looking at the spiritual people who are perhaps sensitive to spirit, so they're picking up on things, and I'm fascinated with that. I'm thinking, oh, that's really interesting. And then, you know, with the skeptics as well, that are trying to look at everything rationally, I'm thinking that's quite interesting as well, you know, because they're trying to break everything down and see if there's a cause. If not, then that makes it a little bit more exciting, because there isn't an explanation as far as we can see. But over time, I stopped doing the public events, and then me and a few people within the society, you know, would go on investigations, not as the society, but as a friendship group, because we were all learning to get to know each other and stuff. And I was then surrounded by people that had been in the paranormal many more years than I have, and seeing how they approach an investigation. So they would be like, okay, let's go into this room and just sit and listen, just hear what are the natural sounds of the building, whether we can hear the creaks, the knocks, can we hear the wind outside, can we, you know, just to kind of like get a feel for the building. Then I remember one investigation, we were sat in a room, and it was the idea was put forward to just write down what you're sensing. Don't tell anybody else. If you hear a bang, instead of vocalizing that and go, oh, did you hear that bang? Because that's really, that's fascinating on investigation, watching people react off of each other. You know, if one person says, oh my God, I feel really, did it just get colder in here? I feel like somebody's here. Then you notice that other people then start going, oh yeah, yeah, I feel that too. Because it's such a social, it's a fascinating situation to be in. So we would do experiments where we'd go, okay, we're just going to sit silent for half an hour, don't react to anything you hear, see, smell, anything like that. Just write it down and write the time down. And then at the end, see if anything can coincide with what anyone else felt and stuff. It's just seeing different ways to approach investigating, because like you said, we don't have all the answers yet. Otherwise, there would be no paranormal field if we had the answers. So I love it. I love the idea of the not knowing, and I love to learn from other people. I have just started doing Kieran O'Keefe's course, the Beginner's Guide to Parapsychology with the School of Parapsychology, because I'm here going, do you know what? I want to learn more about why people are having these experiences, what could be the potential cause, and having a more rational mind. Like, Kieran O'Keefe's fascinating because I can sometimes get a bit carried away and overexcited about things. And then he just goes, okay, but why did you say that? What about this? And I'm like, oh, okay, I didn't think of it like that. Mm. You know, so he really, learning from him, I'm starting to kind of slow down and analyze the entire situation as a whole, rather than getting tunnel vision on a bit of activity and getting overexcited.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating. I love it.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
Have you found that something you thought would have been essential 10 years ago, Leanne, is something that you simply wouldn't use anymore, or you don't think is a valid tool for investigation? Because I've spoken to people that have been ghost hunting for 20 years, and some of them have completely got rid of all their gadgets, and now all they've got is a notebook and a pen, and they just... as you were saying, they just soak in the atmosphere and listen rather than try and prove things everywhere and, you know, setting traps here, there and everywhere and using certain things. And that's not to say that you can't use a variety of things. I think often when it comes to strange phenomena, I think there isn't a one size fits all. But it's interesting that I'm always intrigued by people who have used everything and then have ended up almost going back to basics, as it were.
Yeah, because, well, like we were saying earlier, I think, you know, when people watch paranormal TV shows and they have all of the gadgets and equipment, and I've spoken in the past to TV production companies before and they've said, oh, what's your thoughts on gadgets? And I have to be honest, you know, I completely see why they are needed in paranormal TV, because when I've been on investigations, a lot of the things that I feel or see or hear wouldn't be witnessed by someone sitting at home as a viewer. You know, it's when you've gone to places and you've gone, oh, the vibe here, there's a weird heaviness in the air, or, you know, you see something out of the corner of your eye, like, oh, did you see that over there in the corner? That's not going to be exciting for the viewer. So I get that the flashy lights and the beeps and the spirit boxes and all of that stuff gives something visual and audio, auditory to for the viewer. But using all of that stuff over the years, you do sense unpredictability with a lot of the gadgets. Sometimes I think, like, oh, okay, I'm just going to put on the spirit box or the EMF meter, the K2 meter or the REM pod here, and I'm just going to see what happens in my own home that I know for fact isn't haunted. And it will go off, it will beep, or, you know, it's a battery operated device. There's going to be times when the batteries start to fail and it starts to beep because the batteries are low or something, like faulty wiring. So I can see why veteran investigators are turning their backs on it, because I don't really think it has much, adds much to an investigation. That we're not there yet that we've discovered a device which can sense ghosts or spirits, because we don't know what we're trying to sense or measure yet. They're fun. The gadgets are fun. Like, you know, it's exciting if you are on an investigation and you feel that it gets cold and then a device which measures the temperature starts to beep. You know, it's like, oh, that is validating what I'm experiencing. That can be fun. But then there's a cause for everything. You know, people say that, you know, the EMF's going off, but their phone is also in their hand. You know, so it's, I understand why people like the gadgets. I really do. But I wouldn't say that it's definitive proof of the paranormal if a device starts beeping and flashing.
I'd never used a spirit box till last year. And then I was involved in an investigation in a sort of, we were in a room on our own. There was five of us. And I always thought, to be honest, it was a load of stuff and nonsense. I didn't give it much credence. And I have to say, it's probably one of the most striking things I've ever done in regards to the paranormal. Really? Because I was obviously blindfolded at the same time as well. And I had no indication of what was going on in the room around me.
Esther's method.
Yes. Which I love, because obviously I've seen the Newkirks and others do that. And love so that. I jumped at the chance to try it, because, you know, I can be dismissive of it, but unless I've done it, I don't really think I've got any proof to be dismissive about it. So, you know, I'm not saying I went there to think, oh, this is rubbish. But I have to say, when I look back at it, and even on the night, I was taken aback. I really didn't expect it. And the obvious reactions of everybody around me, because obviously they were keeping notes and what I was saying and things. And afterwards, it was almost as if I was having a conversation based on what was going on that I couldn't see at all. I had no idea what the others were doing. And when I look back at it, it made me think, now, can I really sit here after doing that and be as dismissive? And the answer is no. I don't know what happened, and I'm not going to suggest that it did connect me with something or someone giving me messages from the other side. But what went on and what was noted down made me pause for thought afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the interesting thing about that method of using the spirit box is, like you said, you're blindfolded, you're wearing noise cancelling headphones, so you can't hear the questions that are being asked. So then you're less likely to try and get the what you're hearing to fit the question. You know, I've done it before where you've been on investigations and you've got this spirit box and everybody can hear it, even the people asking the questions, and you have the most nonsensical sound come through and they're saying, it just said John, and it's like, no, it didn't, but you know, because yes. But people so want to have a paranormal experience.
Yeah.
They don't want to go home at the end of the night thinking that nothing happens. So even if they're grasping at straws, they will try and get something to fit. But with that, Esther's method is designed to take that away, that you are just saying what you hear with no idea of what the questions could be. And I find that fascinating. And I'm actually watching Hellier for the third time because I love it. And they're doing the Esther's method. And I'm like, oh, it's fascinating when you are witnessing a conversation happening with someone who is just, I guess, the vessel. Yes. Who is just the messenger passing, you know, that I do get excited with that. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I say, when I was saying earlier on about the addictive qualities of getting into the paranormal, I would probably say, Leanne, if you asked me to put a number on it, I would say I've probably done between 300 and 400 Ouija board sessions. Easily.
Wow.
I would suggest that 99% of them were nonsense. And people manipulating the glasses or the reaction that's caused by a group of people being huddled together around a small table. I mean, we used to show off because we used to do it on a mirror, you know, because you do when you're 17, you think, what the hell? let's push this as far as we can. And we used to do it in an old embalming hut in a churchyard. So how we never got rumbled, I'll never know. But there are a handful of occasions that we did that over the years where I still to this day, and we're talking over 30 years ago, I can remember the three or four occasions where a cold shiver ran up and down my spine several times, or we got communications and strange things happened that at the time didn't make much sense. But in reflection, you think that's a bit odd. that's a bit strange. A couple of them were very dark things that were happening, very strange, odd conversations that were allegedly coming through. But, you know, I was one of those people. I'm not a complete believer, but I'm also, I would like to say I'm a skeptical believer, which when sometimes you talk to the people in the paranormal, that seems like a double negative for some of them. And I'm not really sure, because I think you've got to have a foot in both camps, because as you were saying earlier on, otherwise every bit of dust that turns into an orb is a transcending spirit, and you're never going to get anywhere if that's what you dive straight into. And I think we can often see things, and like you were saying about people mishearing or wanting to hear certain things when they're doing the spirit box, I think you have to take a step back to look at what's going on, to evaluate things properly and thoroughly, because otherwise you just end up chasing yourself into corners where you then start creating a non-existent narrative to explain the experiences you're having, which is not what's happened, and therefore it's not real. It's what you want it to be. And I think, as I say, in the majority of occasions that we were doing it, a lot of it was that. And I would ask questions only I knew the answer. Well, I never got an answer that I knew nobody else knew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we were doing, my aunt had recently passed prior to when we started doing it a lot. Never got told how old she was or what her middle name was. Even though I was with very close friends, nobody could give me those answers. And there, for me, I would always put tests in.
Yeah.
But I did experience a few, like I say, handful of strange occurrences out of all those, which some people would say, well, if you do something enough, you will eventually hit on something that makes you think it's a bit odd. But 30 years on, they've still stayed with me. And that's the thing that struck me when I look back at that. And I look at some of these other messages, like the Estes method and things, that when you do them and you see enough of it, yes, a lot of it is nonsense, but there'll be the one or two things that happen that make you think, I wonder.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like when in the past, when I would do public events, as soon as you said the word Ouija board, you would hear the, like, you know, it's definitely a divisive topic, is the good old Ouija board. Some people are certain that it is a portal to demons and nothing good is going to come through.
Mm-hmm.
And then you will have the people that are like, nope, it's purely the idiomotor effect.
Yes.
And it's funny, like when I was doing an event at the Ancient Ram Inn last year, there was a very diverse group of individuals. Half of them were psychology majors. They were all, you know, working in the psychology field or just coming out of uni. And then you had the other half, which were the believers, you know, been doing this years, loads of things happen whenever I'm on an investigation, tables are flying around the room, you know. So you had a very polar opposite group of people.
Mm.
And we're in one room and somebody and the believers are in the other room. And you can hear them going, wow, spirits, that's amazing, spirits. Can tell, oh, this is fantastic, spirits. Come on, come on. And they're like having a field day in there. And we're in this room trying to do an Ouija board and it is not even budging an inch. I'm getting to the point now where I'm kind of like, oh, God, someone just move it so something would happen, you know. And then the end of the vigil happens and we swap over. So we go into the other room and that team go and that group comes in, tries to do the Ouija board. So we go into the other room and they were the team leader was attempting to do table tipping. So these five or six women stand around this table and the leader was there going, oh, we had it going around the room just then. It was amazing. It was on two legs and it was going out towards the door and back round, and it's just amazing. And then I'm stood there with these psychology majors, very skeptical women. Table again didn't move an inch. But then we can hear the women next door being like, oh my God, spirit, I can't believe you knew that. That's amazing. Did you just see, you just spelled out my nan's name? And I'm just there like, what? It was amazing how you can be in the same building with the same reported phenomena. This, you know, it's the Ancient Ram Inn is well known as being, you know, the most haunted building in the UK. But what I was seeing was a distinct difference between people's beliefs, and that then determined how much activity they got. So then that's what I do believe now, that a lot of it is psychological and what you put out. You know, you hear about people going on investigations and being blockers. Well, I don't believe, so I'm a blocker. Nothing happens when I'm here. And there might be some relevancy to that. I don't know. Again, you know, I'm just making assumptions on what I see. But it is fascinating when you've got a group of people who are diehard believers, they in turn get all the paranormal activity happening to them. And if paranormal activity was an external force, wouldn't the non-believers be experiencing the same thing?
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. I suppose it's one of those questions when we look at it, Leanne, that I always struggled with that kind of situation where you would have a group of people and as you say, certain people would have an experience and nobody else would. And obviously the more I've read and the more I've seen, I began to sort of open myself up to some of the work of some of the early parapsychologists that were basically working on the principle that people weren't seeing them externally. They were experiencing them internally. So we weren't seeing them through our eyes. We were seeing them in our heads, which is not to say that these people are hallucinating or creating a false narrative. It's just that certain people have those experiences, and it doesn't matter how much you believe, you'll never have that experience, because for whatever reason it is, maybe the chemistry of your anatomy isn't the right frequency, or you might exist on a certain different vibrational level. I'm not sure. You may be more susceptible to certain types of infrasound than other people. It could even be as strange as your blood group or your star sign. Who knows? But I think that is one of those things that when you look at parapsychology in comparison to ghost hunting, and as you mentioned, Kieran O'Keefe and someone I recently spoke to earlier this year, Lloyd Auerbach, who's a very famous American parapsychologist. I think sometimes people like Kieran can get tarred with a negative brush, when I think that what they are people that are extremely scientific and very diligent and will remove all the explainable factors that some people either ignore or, as we were saying about creating a false narrative, embrace, even though I think sometimes you could be clutching at straws. And I think often if someone tries to explain the rational parts of what could be happening, some people just shut down rather than think, well, actually, these are very valid points. And I think a lot of the time, and a lot of what we see on television and the like can be explained away as misinterpretation or a lack of knowledge or a failure to understand it, because the vast majority of ghost hunters do not have any connection with parapsychology at all. They are completely different aspect of the paranormal and the way people investigate, which I think a lot of people just don't, not that I wouldn't say put any value in it, but I think people don't seem to realize the vast difference.
Well, that's what I did a talk a couple of weeks ago at a paranormal conference called Scary Southwest. And that was something that I brought up when I was talking, was that, you know, the UK Paranormal Society wants to be inclusive of a variety of viewpoints. We want to hear from the parapsychologists. We want to talk to the spiritualists. We want to learn from all the different viewpoints that actually really, if we all put all of those viewpoints together, we could all learn something from. And you know, another thing that I said as well was that about showing compassion to newcomers to the paranormal field, because, you know, it's quite a daunting place. If you come in as a newbie and you don't know much and you go into a paranormal forum and you say, oh, guys, look what I just caught in this photo. It's an orb. 9 times out of 10, the comments will be really disparaging and quite mean.
Yes.
You know, and that then is giving that person such a negative view of the paranormal that they may not want to delve further. And that person could have been the next leading parapsychologists if we had encouraged them and tried to teach each other with compassion. Mm. You know, say, oh, that's fantastic, but here's a link to an article which breaks down the other causes of anomalies in photographs or photography. Mm. So, you know, and it's, I think as well, like, yeah, you're completely correct. Like, parapsychology is such a vital, important role in the paranormal field. Like, and the one thing that I really like about Kieran O'Keefe is that, yes, he's this well-known parapsychologist, quite skeptical, but he even says, he's like, I'm a Ghostbuster. He goes, I love investigating, you know, and he's very down to earth. And he acknowledges that actually it's really fun investigating. He's like, I enjoy it. So you can have that balance. You can enjoy the investigating and be a skeptic, you know, because they do work, you know, because, and it also, you like we were asking me 10 years ago when I first started out, you know, I was going in with my phone and my gadgets and thinking that all of this was proof of the paranormal. But over the years, you speak to more people, you learn more things, and now you're going in with a different investigative style. Mm. And I'm sure in 10 more years, my investigation style would have changed yet again. So I think it's really important to be fluid with your way that you approach the paranormal. I think actually it's a bit of an injustice if you say, I'm right, I know everything, I'm going to stay and do what I do, and that's the only right way to do it.
Yes. I mean, you were among some luminaries at that conference as well, because obviously talking of parapsychology, she had the marvellous Evelyn Hollow speaking there as well, didn't you?
She is amazing. She's so funny. She literally had the entire room in fits of laughter. And she was like, unapologetically Scottish and swearing. And it was just amazing. It was like, she was great. Yeah.
Yeah. No, she was one of those conversations. I spoke to Evelyn, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago now. And I always enjoy a conversation where I come away from it thinking, I know a lot more than I did 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
You know? And Evelyn's, because she's as sharp as a tack, she's super witty, she's deeply intelligent, yeah, she doesn't take any prisoners as well, which is something I really appreciate with Evelyn and the way she carries herself. And she's gone from being sort of on the fringes a bit to probably being one of the leading lights in the British paranormal scene, which I think is which is testament to the quality of her work.
Yeah, she's so intelligent. She was saying about how she started off doing criminal forensic science. Is that correct?
I think so, yes.
And then she said that she told her professor that she was going to do parapsychology, and he was like, you're committing career suicide. And she was like, I want to find him now and tell him that I am booked up for the next. And I was like, yes, you go, girl. You know, it was like...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she'll be sending him a copy. Yeah, I think she's got a book coming out later this year, so no doubt she'll be sending him an autographed copy with best wishes.
Yeah, too right.
Was that your first conference that you'd had the opportunity to speak to, Leanne?
It was, yeah.
How did you find it?
The first public speaking event, I was so nervous. I haven't gone to many conferences, so I wasn't sure what was expected of speakers. So in my head, I was like, I have to remember a 30-minute talk. It was me and Lauren, who is also another trustee. So I was there like, oh my God, I'm going to have to remember my entire talk off the top of my head with no notes. Like, that's how I thought speakers were supposed to do it.
Yes.
So when I get there and the other speakers actually have some notes in front of them and, you know, are looking down just for references and stuff, I was like, oh, that's allowed? I was like, okay. So yeah, so got up there and like, I talk fast anyway, but add nervousness to that. I'm like a freaking Vicky Pollard on steroids because I'm from Bristol and I'm just like, yeah, thank you. Blah, 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 blah. Wait, yeah, so yeah, so what we're gonna do now is we're gonna talk about paranormal. And I was just like, oh. So no. Afterwards we had some lovely, lovely members of the audience come up to us. And this one woman pulled me and Lauren aside and she was like, girls, just want to say that for your first ever public talk, she was like, I never would have guessed. She said, some people just stand up there and read their notes. But you two had such passion and it was so refreshing. And I was like, oh, I was like, can I take you home? You're so lovely. Can you just give me motivation every day? And yeah, so no, it was good, but it was scary. But do you know what? I think people always say, don't they? They say when you talk about something you're passionate about, it comes across. And, you know, you're in a room full of people that are into the paranormal. And we made sure that our talk wasn't the paranormal police telling people what to do. We're not some big bad organization that thinks we're better than anyone, because that's really not what we're about. Like, we are here for the people that, you know, are going, oh, I don't really know what path resonates with me. Am I more scientific? Do I like the gadgets? Am I more spiritual, you know, or am I more interested in the history of the paranormal, you know? And our website has something for everyone. And I was really trying to get that across in our talk, was that, you know, everyone in the paranormal community is as important as the next. You know, the historians, the parapsychologists, the skeptics, the scientists, the believers, the spiritualists, like, everyone has a unique viewpoint. And I think, you know, all it takes is for one person who's been very tunnel vision to listen to someone else's viewpoint and be like, oh, wow, I didn't see it from that perspective before, but now that's going to maybe potentially change the way I look at phenomena going forward. And I think that's really important. And like the question you asked me earlier about, you know, when is it ethical to investigate in relation to, you know, how many years after someone's passed? And we don't have those answers as the UK Paranormal Society. I don't have those answers as Leanne. But those are the type of conversations which I think are really important to have in the community, because it might, you know, we might come to a solution as a paranormal community and go, actually, guys, let's all agree to not investigate places where somebody literally died this many years ago. Or if a family member has said, please don't do this, maybe respect that and don't do it. You know, I think it's like, we don't have the answers, but I think having those conversations is really beneficial to the community as a whole.
Well, absolutely. And I think this is another aspect of why I appreciate you. I mean, you've got a brilliant website with some fabulous articles. I'm always a big supporter of anybody that does a well-written article on the one of my favourite weird cases, which is the Highgate Vampire. Which I never tire of listening to, because as a younger person, I remember the Reverend Sean Manchester appeared on Radio 1, which is one of those weird things looking back, when they do interviews with Nicky Campbell on Radio 1 late at night, and it was a cold, dark, wet Yorkshire night, and I was laid in bed listening to Sean Manchester tell these tales about what was going on in Highgate Cemetery in the late 60s and early 70s. And it blew my mind. And it blows my mind even now that I think here we had 50 years ago, we had mobs of people descending on a major cemetery in London on the hunt for vampires at the end of the swinging 60s, which is baffling to me and everything I know about that era, that all of a sudden it was almost as if Hammer horror films had burst into real life for a lot of people at that particular period. It's a crazy situation.
Yeah, I personally don't know too much about the Highgate Vampire, because I didn't write that article. So I could probably learn something from you on that topic. But I think you do find, don't you, when stories like that start coming out, people are fascinated and start, you know, going in droves to the area because they want to witness something. And I'm trying to think of a more recent case where I can say, oh, that's similar to, I don't know, I can't think. Can you think of any recent cases, like big paranormal cases, where it's the public have flocked to try and witness something?
I'm not sure in the UK. I mean, obviously you could certainly point, I would suggest, for better or worse, Amityville's probably the most recent one where people just randomly turned up, because when you see some of the stories there, and you've got these poor people who bought the house after the Lutzes had gone, and people were just turning up and taking bits of the fence and just going, yeah, I love that, thanks, that's from Amityville, I'll have that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, like dark tourism, like people want that memorabilia, don't they, you know, like, oh, a signed picture that Charles Manson drew from prison. You know, it's like, and people want that because I think that as well. I think it shows people's emphasis that they put on, I guess, energy. They think, oh, well, you know, I'm getting something of this, you know, like where they say like part of the fence.
Yes.
That this inanimate object, which is just a bit of wood, is I don't know. It's just they put so much value into it. And it makes you think that do they really believe that they are taking something of that haunting with them? I don't know. But yeah, people love collecting like items connected to paranormal cases because I don't know.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst, so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
Yes. Well, I think it's one of those, be careful what you wish for, I think, Leon. You may be bringing something home you may not wish to really have in your home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tell that to my partner when I'm buying dodgy dolls from Facebook Marketplace. And he's like, can you put that in the garage? The kids don't need to see that. And I'm like, okay. Like, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I can't say anything. I've got a Bigfoot cast on my shelves behind me, so from Bluff Creek. So what can I say?
that's wow.
Strange things. I mean, you've mentioned it earlier, and we've touched on it a couple of times. How do you end up at the Ancient Ram Inn? Because I think this is one of those places that, for us here in the UK, it's one of those very well known. And you mentioned it earlier on, Pontefract. Mm. East Drive, obviously, yeah. Fairly local to me, being in not too far away here in Yorkshire. And obviously where I am, we've got Stocksbridge Bypass, which is infamous, for better or worse. But I think the Ram Inn's one of those where, it for me, it's almost when you know you are immersing yourself into the paranormal that you know about these locations. Mm-hmm. So for you, it wasn't just that you went there, you ended up being a tour guide, didn't you?
Yeah. So it was January last year, started working at the Ram again, saw an advert on Facebook saying we need a tour guide for the daytimes. And I was like, have to apply. And went to the Ram, met Caroline. I said I was local to the area because I only live about 15-20 minute drive away. So I was like, I'm local. I'm very flexible. So I was like, you know, ready to go, basically. So I started working there. And do you know what? I always felt comfortable there. It was very cold because obviously I was doing the tours, I think, from January to May.
Yeah.
And it was always freezing in there. I remember going around with a hot water bottle, you know, like it was so cold. But what I loved was that it was an hour-long tour, so it was a history tour. So people weren't necessarily there on a paranormal investigation because, obviously, you know, then they're expecting a heck of a lot more for their buck when they're expecting a demon. But when they're there just paying for the history tour, they're happy just to get the history. You know, if something spooky happens, then it's an added bonus. But I met some amazing people from Australia that were coming over to England, and they were getting married in Gretna Green. They were going down to the London. They were going to go to the Ancient Ram Inn. They were going all over the UK. And then I had people from America. A place like the Ancient Ram Inn is worldwide famous, you know. So, you know, I'm there talking about the history of the building. Half of them are probably just not even paying attention, and they're just like, oh my god, this is so cool, you know, looking around at all the amazing, you know, they've got like at the top of the stairs, they've got the nine men's Morris that has been etched into the stone. And some of the stone was brought over from Kingswood Abbey when the churches were the dissolution of the churches. And yeah, so there was stone from Kingswood Abbey that was brought over. They're just, yeah, that, you know, you look into the walls and you have the original structure, which was the horsehair and the bamboo wattle and daub structure. Yep. And it's just the building, take away the paranormal stuff. The building in itself is beautiful and steeped in history. And that was what was amazing is that, yeah, I was doing the history tours and but people were just fascinated to be there. But I felt I had to be there on my own a lot of the time, you know, in between tours. And I felt quite comfortable. And I would go up to the you know, what they call the witch's room with Elspeth, who was a falsely accused witch in the 1600s because she was having an affair with one of the local priests from the church. And because he no longer wanted to see her and he was scared of any sort of repercussions, he said, oh, she's a witch, she's, you know, enticed me, kind of thing, and she was killed. Well, at least that's the one of the famous stories that goes alongside the Ancient Ram Inn. But I would go up to that room and sit there on the bed and would just, you know, talk and be, hi Elspeth, it's me, Leanne, how are you, you know. And just because I thought, you know, if they were there, you know, intelligently there, I wanted to maybe just sit and talk to them without doing the whole go on if you're here knock.
Yeah,
because I bet they were like, oh, they're sick to death of that. But, but yeah, no, it is a lovely building. And yes, yeah, I was very lucky.
Which is the room you've got to knock on? Is it knock on it three times that you
the
before
Bishop's
you enter
room
it? Yeah, so was, yeah, that is that still got its reputation? Because obviously I remember seeing
John Humphreys. Yeah,
I remember seeing John Humphreys many years ago on a program, and he was giving somebody a tour of the building, and one of the things that always struck me during that particular program was this, the Bishop's room, where he had a special stick that he would knock three times on it and,
yeah,
say, can
it
I come
like
in
a staff. Yeah, and he would knock, dunk, dunk, dunk. He's like, can I come in? And then, yeah, the staff's still there. It's hung up just outside the door. So that was one thing. When we would do the tour, we would say, you know, John, who used to live here, would always knock on the door and, you know, ask if he could go in, because it was the Bishop's room, which was seen as a very, we wanted to be respectful to the, you know, the religious figures that are supposed to be in that room. So it was, yeah, it was his way of showing respect.
Yeah, because it's a very strange building anyway, because I think, did John buy it because it was going to get pulled down and he got it for a ridiculous price?
It was going to get knocked down, and he bought it for, I can't even remember off the top of my head now. It was either something like £7,000 or £70,000. It was it was a very small amount for that building in at the end of the 60s. I think it was 69 that he got the building. But it was going to get knocked down. And he was a lover of history himself. And he was like, no, I can't allow that to happen. And he got the building because they wanted to widen the road out the front, because the road going through Wootton is very small.
Yeah.
Because that town is so old. Apparently it was one of the first towns that has proof of the Bronze Age or something. It's like, it's ridiculously old. And that building is said to date back to 1145, and it's probably sturdier than half of the new Bovis homes going up nowadays. So it's done something right.
I mean, it's one of those things as well, Leanne. Did it have a reputation before John bought it? Or because as far as I remember, it literally kicked off within a week or so of him moving in, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So Caroline told me that it was literally the first night that they were there. John and his wife had set up a bed in the working men's kitchen, and he, within the first night, got dragged out of bed and he was on the floor like, what the heck just happened? And I said to Caroline, I said, well, did you witness it? And she said, well, me and my sister were literally so young And because the building needed so much work, we were living in a caravan that was outside the house. So she said we were out from the property. Everything that was happening to my dad, they were completely unaware. But not that I'm aware of. I don't know any ghost stories that happened prior to John moving in. But I guess that is, you know, could be because of the time. You know, if people have a paranormal experience nowadays, they put it online, it instantly gets shared and everyone knows about it. In the 50s or 60s, did people talk about ghosts as much? Were the stories as widely spread back then? I don't know. But again, I guess that's one of the criticisms, I guess, of the RAM is that, oh, well, the stories only started after John moved in. But Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's one of those things. I think people's interest in the paranormal's always been with us, Leanne, because you can only see, you can see how much of the country embraced spiritualism after the First World War.
Yeah.
And visiting mediums and the like. And it seemed to drop away again after the Second World War, which is a very interesting sort of counterpoint to that whole belief system, I think. But then you only have to look at some of the people that came forward with stories of hauntings that made the major press in Britain in the 50s and early 60s and how they were ridiculed, that often ghost stories were sort of the preserve of the upper classes and the ghost club and the likes of Peter Underwood, who would write these collections where, as far as I'm aware, and I own most of Peter Underwood's books, I don't think he did many sort of residential properties or what you would consider a normal person story. It was always sort of in some wonderful manor house or some former bishop's residence somewhere in Suffolk or Devon, or in a castle somewhere in Scotland, enjoying the hospitality of people. And he was never sort of in a two up, two down in Taunton, shall we say.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So, I mean, for you going forwards and the rest of the UK Paranormal Society, what is next for you guys? You've obviously created this and you're 5 years now since you've been a fully flourished organisation. Have you begun to feel that the aims that you're wanting to promote, because obviously there's a lot of inclusivity in this, there's a lot of, as I mentioned it, I didn't mean it flippantly, but I think there's a lot of people in the UK especially who seem to be sort of coming together as a more unified paranormal group or a community where it's more supportive than it used to be. It's been very fractious, as with anything I've found over the years, Leanne, that deals with the weird, be it ufology or cryptozoology. The paranormal is exactly the same, that you have factions that this is why this house is haunted, that's what it means, these are the beliefs, and if you disagree with that, then no, we don't want to talk. Whereas yourself and the rest of the organisation, it seems to push forward a positive message about, as you mentioned earlier on, listening to people's viewpoints. And yes, we may think that what they have to say may not be valid or have any merit, but it's not pointing fingers and ridiculing any people anymore. It's more of an educational and cross-pollination of ideas from all sides of the paranormal field, where we can try and not necessarily all come to the same conclusions, but certainly be a bit more respectful about people's differing opinions and beliefs in this field.
Yeah, 100%. And this is what is really important to us, is that inclusivity. And like I mentioned before, our articles are written from a variety of viewpoints. So I truly hope that our articles don't come across as one-sided or biased towards one sort of area of the paranormal. It's very fact-based and people can take away what resonates with them. But no, going forward, I think so. We actually, I know you said we've been a fully fledged organization for 5 years. It's actually only been since October 2022. Oh. So October 2022 was when we launched, but we started setting it up in January 2019. So we are a baby still compared to the likes of the Ghost Club and SPR and even ASAP.
Yeah.
We are very new, so we are not at the level of prestige or as those organizations. You know, when other paranormal figures are talking about the paranormal organizations, we might not be on their radar yet because we are still new, and that's what we're going to be aiming to do over the next year, 18 months, gets our profile out there. And also, we're not just aiming to focus on the people within the paranormal community. We also want to focus on the members of the public, you know, the heritage organizations as well. You know, people who might not have an understanding of the paranormal, who might be new to the field. We also want to you know, target them as well. So, yeah, going forward, that's what we're going to try and do, is just get our name out there and continue to do so by being on, you know, podcasts and speaking to our peers and stuff, because we want to people within the field to you know, pick their brains and go, what would you like to see? Because that's the only way that we can go help the community.
So where can everybody find your organization, follow you online, and keep up to date with everything that's going on with you guys?
So we are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and that's the UK Paranormal Society. And our website is www.ukparanormalsociety.org.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes as always, Leanne. And I want to say thank you very much for fitting me in. And it's been lovely to spend some time in your company.
Oh, it's been fantastic. I've had a great night. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.